here in this room, and glad that all those out there watching online are able to participate. It's a good day. I'm looking forward to class as always. I was just sort of noticing the AV situation changes. They're always making it better. And they've added, well, they've had them up there for a while, but they've been adjusting them. These four spotlights shine right down on the stage. It's very nice because I can't see almost anything down the middle of the room. I can see the screen. I can see off to the sides pretty well. Hey, how y'all doing? But right down the pipe, man, I seen you there. What's fascinating is they said they turned it down to half power. They turned it up full power, and if they can, I can't even see the microphone. But I hope you all are well. I'm just doing that so they can set the sound levels. There's no purpose to that conversation whatsoever, except a technical support. It is my second class. We talked about last week on the Star of Bethlehem. I did that because, in simple terms, because I wanted to. It's always been a fascinating account to me, and I think it has some. It's a familiar story. It's also a very good thing to teach if you're not even Bible literate, or if you're new to it and learning. You almost certainly know the Christmas nativity story because it's celebrated in song and all sorts of other things, and not to mention a major economic impact of the country and the world. So last Wednesday was the day of Epiphany, as noticed or as acknowledged by primarily the Catholic Church, December 25th being the traditional birth date of Jesus, and January the 6th being the arrival of the Magi, or arrival of the wise men. Count off the days, 12 days, and that leads you to a famous Christmas carol where the 12 days of Christmas comes from. That's where that originates. But anyway, that was last week. Nothing else exciting happened last week, did it? What a week. So I'm back on to what I'm primarily focused on is this discussion that Tom started, which I'm going to follow along with him. Tom will teach next week. If he doesn't know that, I can't see. He's right there, I think. I hope he's nodding. It's this idea of return to normalcy. And so we have heard it. We've all heard that sort of discussion. We all have that. A lot of people have expressed a desire to return to normal. And so Tom has articulated a thesis that says that what we think is normal, the world's normal, is abnormal. And our abnormal is the world's normal. And so maybe we shouldn't try to think about returning to pre-March habits. You know, March being, I guess, when the impact of COVID finally hit the country. I think they began shutting things down. I was watching basketball and it stopped. You know, all that was happening in March. And so maybe our goal is not to get back to March. And Jesus does not call us to return to that, because that's just another abnormal. It is no more abnormal now than then. It is equally abnormal in the way the world was made. We want to go back further. Okay. We want to go back to what God intended for man. And so that is a world of no death. That's a world of a lot of different things. God walking among us. God walked in the garden. And then when Jesus came, his name, Emmanuel, is God is with us. He is among us on this earth, living, walking, talking, all those kinds of crazy things. And that's what we want to return to. So maybe we ought to set goals of not trying to get back to March, but trying to get back to what we were made to be. And when we do, the world will think that we are bizarre and abnormal. And there's repercussions. There's costs to that sort of abnormality. But we want to talk about some of those today. So that is, you know, I'm always seem to move faster in my own charts. I got to learn to manage my own charts better. So that is, we don't want to go back to March. We want to go back to what we were created to be. So here's our verse for the day. And so I'm, if you will, if you'd like to turn to it, that's great. If you don't, you can read it off the screens behind you, or I may switch to my Bible directly. But Matthew, the 5th chapter. We're going to look at verses 38 to 42. And up on the chart, I put in another passage. Okay, a Levitical passage. And the reason it's there, because that is a quote. Okay, so while that is not actually in the scripture itself, in what Jesus' words were, Jesus didn't pause and say, see Leviticus 24:20. He's quoting it, and we'll go back and look at that verse here in a minute as well. So it is, if you'll read with me, you have heard that it was said. So this whole thing is in 3 chapters as recorded in Matthew, is the Sermon on the Mount. It is as early in Jesus' ministry that we really have recorded. He was baptized possibly a few days before, weeks, maybe a week before. We're not real sure. Probably a very short amount of time. He has now stepped up. And he's come to a mountaintop, hence the name Sermon on the Mount. He has come to a mountaintop that's unnamed, okay? And he's beginning to preach. What's intriguing is, since I'm a shadows kind of person who likes to look at Old Testament, when the Jews crossed the Jordan and they conquered Jericho and they went north, the first thing that they did, God told them to do, was go stand on Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim, and they were to cross through this mountain, pass through a pass in the mountain, and they were to call out curses if you disobeyed the law. Jesus does the same thing. He comes from the Jordan. He heads north to a mountain. Whether it's Gerizim or Ebal, I do not know, but I've long suspected that it's one of them. And instead of calling down curses, he says, blessed are those. He calls down blessings. This is all part of, in essence, the law. And Jesus is not giving new law, he is explaining the law. Okay, and so this is now going to become the basis of Christianity, what he's going to say. So let's start over. Verse 38. You have heard that it was said, eye for eye and tooth for tooth. But I tell you, do not resist an evil person. If someone strikes you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if someone wants to sue you and take your tunic, let him have your cloak as well. If someone forces you to go 1 mile, go with him 2 miles. Give to the one who asks you, and do not turn away from the one who wants to borrow from you. So, this is in conflict with every American movie ever made. Okay? Movies that have this attitude are not made. You know, revenge as disguised as justice is generally the model. Whether you are an Avenger, or whether you are some other superhero, or you're, you know, or whether you're just an everyday person, really unhappy, it is vengeance disguised as justice. Nothing in here would sell on the big screen. Okay? And so this, when he says, you have heard that it was said, this is an important point I want to point out. He is quoting, actually there's 3 different places in the Old Testament where this quote is made, all related to the law, because the law was told in multiple times in the Old Testament with Moses, but this is the Levitical one I've recorded. There's one in Deuteronomy, and I think there's one in Exodus. It's close enough. He is saying, you have heard it said not from your mama. You have heard it said from the internet, which is with its reliability. You have heard it said from Scripture itself. So that means it's right. He's not saying that what was said was wrong because it came from God himself. But you have not read it. So let's look at the Levitical. Is that my next chart? Oh, no, it's not. I don't mean to look at that yet. We'll look at it here in a minute. And so this idea of right now is now predominant in this passage. And when it says, if someone strikes you, let them strike you again. That doesn't sound like the American way. If it says he takes your stuff, give him more. Again, not sounding like the American way. And they are a conflict with your rights. Your life is the slapping. And this is the quote as written by, not president at the time, but Mr. Jefferson. He actually quotes a philosopher, a British philosopher named John Locke. And this is how it's recorded in what we call the Declaration of Independence. We hold these truths to be self-evident, which means I don't have to explain it to you. You should know that. That all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Mr. Locke, that Mr. Jefferson is quoting, actually said life, liberty, and the pursuit of property. Okay? Which is, Jefferson thought was a little crass. Because when you own a big mansion on a hilltop in Virginia, you don't think about property when you have it all. Okay? So Jefferson thought it was crass, and he altered it to happiness. If your happiness is in property, then there you go. Okay? And so when you read this passage, if he takes your tunic or your shirt, give him your jacket, that's your pursuit of property, isn't it? You have a right to your clothing. You don't have to give it up. Your life and your liberty is about being thrown in jail or being forced to do something. Life is about your physical being. So if someone slaps you, you have a right to not be slapped. Okay? That's what that says. And while the Declaration of Independence is not law, okay, nor is it American law, it is the philosophical basis for the U.S. Constitution, which is U.S. law. So our culture and our law, and this is a capturing of our culture, that we don't have to give this stuff up. We don't have to give our stuff. We cannot harm us. You cannot imprison us, and you cannot take our stuff. That's what that says. Okay? Without a really, really good reason. And those reasons have to be adjudicated through various processes. They can take your stuff, right? The second you pay a tax, they took your stuff. Okay? That's what that is. They took it. They said, and if you don't give it to them, then they then attack your liberty and your life. Okay? So if you commit a crime, you forfeit your liberty, in theory. If you do a crime bad enough, you potentially forfeit your physical being. But those things should be exceptions. And the whole basis of U.S. law, and really for that matter, Western culture is formed, this idea captures it. And it forms our thinking too. Okay? But how does that compare to what we just read in Matthew? So, the world emphasis, the world's emphasis, I don't know if you can read that. This is now in that space where I can. I'm having trouble. But since I made them, I know what it says. So if you look at the Alabama state motto, we dare defend our rights. Matthew 4:5, right? No. Liberty or death, okay. Don't tread on me. That sound like a defense of your rights? Don't you dare. Don't you dare harm me. New Hampshire, one of the most easygoing states in the country, unlike Idaho, whose state motto on their license plate is great potatoes or something. What is it? Famous potatoes. I'm sorry, I didn't want to get, I'm error there. New Hampshire is live free or die, okay? Liberty or nothing. And then our idol to liberty, standing in the New York Harbor, is Lady Liberty herself. When you come to this country, we tell you, this is important to us. This is what the country is about. And I do not want to minimize any of those things. I am delighted that I have those liberties and freedoms. I am thrilled to have that opportunity. They are good things. I would not want to relinquish any of them. I don't want to pay one more dollar in tax than I have to. And for all those who care, I pay everything that I'm required to. Okay. And the only thing I laugh every year is when on the little IR, the tax form says, do you want to add a dollar for candidates to run their elections? Well, no. That makes me laugh that they even asked. Okay? I don't know if any of y'all have ever given that dollar. I want to come hug you if you do. More of a reassurance hug. It's going to be okay. Things are not that bad. Okay? But no, I don't want to give them a dollar. I would rather take the dollar in the front yard and set it on fire. Okay? And the law allows me to do that. Okay? So it's not arson, remember, to make a claim against it. You can burn it all you want. My property, right? And so it is embedded into our minds. It is embedded into our hearts. And is embedded to what we believe and therefore what we do. And so my first thing, I think this is my next chart. Here's the Leviticus passage. Let's go read Leviticus. Okay, because I don't think there's ever a good Bible class that doesn't make a reference to Leviticus. The 24th chapter of Leviticus, the passage is up in front of you. If anyone takes the life of a human being, verse 17, he must be put to death. Okay. If anyone who takes the life of someone's animal must make restitution life for life. So if I run over your dog, I got to get you another dog. Okay? That's what that says. If I do something and you have a mule or a cow or some other animal damaged, I must restore that damage. If anyone injures his neighbor, now this is where it gets interesting. Whatever he has done must be done to him. Fracture for fracture, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. As he has injured the other, so he is to be injured. Whoever kills an animal must make restitution, but whoever kills a man must be put to death. You're to have the same law. So when Jesus says, you have heard it said, this is where they've heard it. You know. And part of me actually likes that idea, especially if I'm on the receiving end. So, in a sense, if you were to back out of here and hit my car on the way out, it says, according to the law of Moses, you must restore my car, whether that be take it down and get it repaired, and get me one of similar make and model. You know, that's what it means. And you know what? If you backed into my car, I don't know how to say this, I would expect you to restore my car. If I borrowed something of yours and broke it, I believe I am obligated to restore it. Okay? But some things can't be restored, can they? If you backed over a child, I don't know how to restore that, right? Well, I do know how, but it's just like subsystems are all inoperative. Okay? I don't know how to restore that. And it'd be my own life that would be given in its place. And so Jesus is not saying here in Matthew that God was wrong. Because there's a part that if you, let me go back and see if I can go back. You have heard, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, but I tell you is not a statement that the previous statement was wrong. It is telling you that even though you can demand it, you are not required to demand it. Okay? If you backed into my car and you said, man, bad luck for you, and left, I got to state this correctly. This is going to be sensitive. I am allowed by law to demand it, but I am not required by law to demand it. Okay? In other words, I can just say, I got it. It's okay. Okay? What Jesus is saying here is that is the right way. It doesn't mean that I cannot accept the restitution. It just means I should not demand restitution. And that is a whole different story altogether, I think. Let's go back forward a moment. The existence of rights is not questioned in Scripture. And in fact, they are good. If you were to live in an entire culture that would not restore your property, it'd be on the verge of chaos quickly. Okay? Quickly. I mean, like this afternoon, quickly. If you were in a family that did not care for each other's stuff, it would be ugly quickly. Okay? And Jesus is not saying that these rites are not good. They are good. And in a place and culture that practices it, it's good. If you were to damage my... If every time you borrow money from me, you refuse to pay it back, there would be a temptation on my part to never loan you a nickel again. Okay? If I damaged your stuff every time I borrowed it, I'm pretty sure before long, you'd be overwhelmed with the temptation to never loan me a thing again. Okay? And I would actually understand that. But that relationship gets strained when that happens. We may just let it go, but it's tough. But respecting rights and following rights does lead to good relationships. And in a national sense, it leads to good citizenship. It's a good thing. We don't want to live in a culture in which no rights or no property is, or none of your personal rights are defended. None. Okay. So I'm not questioning that the rights are there. I'm not questioning that the rights are good. And I'm not questioning that the rights, when practiced, leads to good things. And I don't think Jesus is questioning them either. But what he calls us to do that is abnormal, this is where it gets abnormal. You understand that rights are normal? The world's normal? What Jesus calls us to do is to willingly relinquish our rights. When pressed. And this is in contrast, in violation to everything we believe. And it's not, and there's two ways. Let's say this gentleman, you're much bigger, much stronger than me. If he comes up and knocks me out and takes my wallet, I did not give him $20. Okay? It wasn't my love that gave him the $20. It was my inability to stop the $20 from being taken from me. Okay? So if something is stolen from you, you didn't relinquish it out of love. It was taken from you, and you couldn't stop it. You don't get to claim faith. Okay? You can claim victimhood, but you can't claim faith. But if we give up our rights willingly, he says, I need $20 and I need it now and I ain't ever going to pay it back, give you the $20. I got a feeling I'm going to walk out of here today with $20 less than I came in with. I just got a feeling before this day's over, someone's going to ask for my $20. And we don't do it out of fear. Once again, not faith. And we don't do it because we had no other choice. We do it because we choose to. We allow it. So under Roman law, and Jesus is actually referencing Roman law here in the Matthew, though it doesn't, the people standing there know it, but you may not. Since Jews were not Roman citizens, and if they were, they certainly were the exception, i.e. Paul, okay, but most Jews, and Jesus was not a Roman citizen, therefore he did not have the protections of the Roman government afforded to citizens. And in this, their army was scattered throughout the world protecting this empire, and their law was, if you came, he's carrying his stuff, if he's moving from one post to another post, and he's got a heavy load, he can conscript you, okay, by force to carry his stuff. And the law limits that right, that authority, to, a mile, okay? So if I'm walking along and I pass Roman soldier passes a Jewish person, he says, carry this, my bag. He is required to carry it. What's he surrendering his right? His life, right? His time, right? He has to give that up and carry that stuff for a mile. I'm sure at a mile, he's going to throw that stuff down and be done with it. What Jesus says, no. Don't do that. Carry it another mile. Not angrily, lovingly. Is this, now which one is abnormal, right? And Jesus is telling us this is the new normal. That all that you thought before was abnormal. Yes, you are required to restitute, but you can give more. And he is making a clear statement to this effect. If someone steals your stuff, then you can give them more stuff. So if you ever read the book Les Miserables, Les Miserables, I was from West Kentucky, Les Miserables, one of the stories, I saw the play, and I have to admit to being disappointed with the play, because the play seemed to make it more gaudy, a little cruder. The key point of the play was a man robbed a priest. The priest helped him out. He got him off the street. He was able to feed him. But the priest had silver, I think silver, silverware, silver dishes and the like. The man stole it and ran. He gets caught by the French police. He is brought back to, I guess the silver has markings on it, or somehow they know that it's from this priest's home. They brought it back. The man back, the thief back, and the silver, and they said, is this your stuff? So how did the priest respond? Y'all know the story? You forgot the rest of it. You didn't get all that I gave you. He turns over the remaining silver to this thief, and the thief knows. Okay. So he's received a form of grace, both mercy for not being arrested and grace. He got the extra silver, and the priest sent him on his way. That is abnormal. And it's going to lead to a transformative story with this man, Jean Valjean, I think is his name. Jesus showed us, so when you create the world, you are in charge. You understand that? If you made everything that's in the world, you are in charge. You own it all. And so when Jesus showed up on the world, he is the boss. The winds and the waves obey him, right? People, on the other hand, do not. And so he had every right there was to be acquired. No one could lay a hand on him if he did not want them to. No one could put him on a cross if he did not allow it. No one. The story is he could have called the angels to come protect him. He didn't need the angels. That just makes it really lopsided. He didn't need the angels. He could have. And so when he gave up all this stuff, he gave it all up. Not that he didn't have the right. He chose to give it up out of love. So I don't know how to, I was looking at this, when I made this chart, I wasn't sure how to write it. So I'm not sure I did the thought well. So let's just step into it and see where it takes us. I think the marketing of the Savior to the world is a wee bit one-sided. And I don't think that's necessarily bad. I'm just saying that when we find someone who we're trying to share the gospel with, we generally try to teach them of the good things they are about to receive. Most people are susceptible to the gospel, or are willing to listen to the gospel message because they're in some need. Men and brethren, what shall we do? Right? That's what they said to Peter on the day of Pentecost. That's a people in need, right? They're concerned that they have committed a grave crime, that they are doomed for that grave crime, and they are now looking for answers, right? This is not a love-motivated question. It doesn't sound like a love-motivated question to me. It sounds to me like a fear-motivated question to me, okay? And so we come with broken relationships, we come with broken bodies. If you ever look at our prayer requests, and those things should and continue, if it's not relationships, it's your body, right? We ask for healing, someone's sick, restored finances, overcoming other struggles, and all of these are legitimate. And so we want to tell the world that if you change the way you see the world and you change the way your belief leads you to your actions, there's some good things to come. And I certainly would not tell you that an unchristian marriage is going to be a better marriage. You would think a marriage in which both husband and wife follow Christ is going to lead to a better marriage. You do. And yes, it could lead to potentially better finances if you don't seek security in money. You seek your security in the Lord, and then your dependency on the money goes less, and then your need to acquire, to prove to others that you've acquired, you know, all that stuff has the potential to lead to good things in this world. And we do not claim that there are no good things in this world. There are good things in this world to receive. And they're real. And they are achievable. but there are also costs. The cost is the world's repercussions of your unconditional love. And I spent several minutes trying to come up with a definition of unconditional love, and this is my definition. That's love without conditions. And I know that seems like I've got 5 college degrees and they're maybe not being used, okay? I think it's 3 college, 3? I forgot, 3 I think. And a high school diploma. I think that this doesn't show a form of education, but I think it does. Because the term unconditional love has become so common that we no longer think about what it means. And it means love without conditions. And I think we add conditions all the time to our love. Try some of these. If the word unless comes up in your explanation of your action, it is now conditioned. I will love my enemy unless he starts it. Okay? If they are not worthy, I am no longer required to give them my love. So we talked a little bit about last week why I think Joseph, the husband of Mary, earthly father of Jesus, that Joseph, why I thought he deserved a speaking part in the Christmas play. Okay, and that is because when his fiance turns up pregnant and he knows he's not the one, there's only 2 people who know, Joseph and Mary. Everyone else is unsure, or maybe they are sure and they're accusing. Okay? Mary's explanation that the Lord did it probably is not going to fly in most family gatherings. Okay? Just be right. If your daughter came to you and said, I didn't do anything, the Lord came on me. Right? That's not going to fly. So, Mary, in the eyes of Joseph, has become unworthy. Right? If your fiance shows up pregnant and you know you're not the one, she is not worthy. He still did not relinquish his love for her because he sought to put her away quietly to protect Mary, because it was in Joseph's interest to take her, blame Mary, so as to protect him from the accusation. That's a guy. Okay? So if your wife is unworthy, husbands, you have no right whatsoever to relinquish your love and act in her best interest. If you don't think so, you think that's a little extreme, read Hosea, okay? In which his wife is a prostitute. And he is not allowed to cease to love her. Do you think you would justify that if a friend came up to you and said, your wife is walking the street, you should divorce her? No, I will continue to do what's best for her. Are you insane? Right? That's the next line. And the answer is, yes, you are abnormal to the world. If your husband is unworthy, you are not allowed to relinquish your love, which is act in his best interest. If a government official is unworthy, and they all are, you are not allowed to remove your respect for them. Honor the king, right? Show respect to the authorities. And there is no unless in that statement. Unless they aren't worthy. Do you know who Jesus was talking about when he made that statement? You have not yet seen unworthy ever described until you read about Tiberius Caesar, who was the Caesar at the time of Jesus' ministry. Or when Paul makes the quote, and he's now talking about either Nero or possibly even Caligula, These are unworthy people. And yet, there is no condition to the statement to love. There isn't one. They are evil. Yes, they are. You think if you show respect to them, you're supporting their evil position. No, you're not. They did not live up to their Christian claims. No, they didn't. They didn't. You're not allowed to treat someone poorly because you think they violated your sense of right and wrong. Never, ever. Read this passage if you want to get shook up. 1 Corinthians chapter 6. I'm going to read it off the screen. And this is my belief of what this thing says. If any of you have a dispute with another, do you dare to take it before the ungodly for judgment instead of before the Lord's people? And there's some skip verses there. But instead, one brother takes another to court, and this in front of unbelievers. The very fact that you have lawsuits among you means that you read this. You have been completely defeated already. That's a nasty, strong statement. Why not rather be wronged? Why not rather be cheated? Is that turn the cheek? Right? That's what it is. That is an implementation of Jesus saying, turn the other cheek. Why not be wronged? And so whether that is, in this context, it's literally a court, it's a lawsuit, but it could be the court of public opinion, it could be any other outward display. If someone says something that you do not like, you're not allowed to challenge, okay, think about this. You're not allowed to condemn them, especially in front of others. If you have issue, you go to them directly and alone. Why? Because you're not there to destroy them. We believe if we defend one side, we can justify harming another. That is a lie. It's a lie. And if we act that way, we're not going to lose. We are beaten. And in this context, beaten is bad. So here's what I would do. My love for my passions and my beliefs must never exceed my love for you. Must never. So I think there's a football game tomorrow. I know some of you are probably passionate about it. I suffer from a great deal of hoo-ha. I have seen these things turn ugly between people. Really? Over a game? How can you express that lack of love? And that's a minor thing. I'm telling you, there's bigger and more important things. And there are people with strong opinions. It is better to say nothing than to say something openly. It's okay to shut your mouth. You say, well, they're in the wrong. Okay, they're in the wrong. God will deal with them. And if you love them, go talk to them quietly. But airing it out in public never convinced anybody. If you're airing it out in public, you're not likely trying to solve a problem. You're trying to express your own. And all that does is amplify the whole thing. Speak peaceably. Speak with encouragement. Speak with the goal of converting and changing. And you know, if at the very end you just can't do it, why not be wronged? Just be wronged. And so this is, if there's anything abnormal in the world, Tom, this is abnormal. And this is exactly what is the normal for us. I don't want to go back to March. I want to go back to this. And I have to admit, I really don't want to go back to that. There's a cost I got to pay. And it, you know, doesn't always set well. but that's only my own shortcomings. I think I'm certainly know I'm out of time. My chart doesn't go forward, so I guess you all shut me down. Is that a way to say be quiet? You can say that directly, but not out in public. That's not a good thing to do. Is that it? Is that the last one? Oh, great. That was my get off the stage moment. All right. In this case, literally. So, do not allow your seeking of truth and justice and being right to overwhelm your love for someone. You know, we just got to stop this. If we want the world to be normal, it's got to be abnormal, and we got to be something different. And it will lead to good and better things. So, there we go. That was kind of downer. Tom will be back next week. He's more fun and exciting. I don't know if he is or not. I don't think he is. Thoughts, questions? I'm over time. I have a clock up there that tells me so. You all have a great day, great rest of the week. I look forward to seeing you.